Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Eric LeMay, a host on New Books in Literature, a channel on the New Books Network. Today I interview Mary Capello about her new book, Lecture. Although I almost hesitate to call it a book, it's much more, like all great lectures are, a performance, one full of erudition and insight, humor and humanity, profound diversions and wry musings, one asking for your most acute attention and simultaneously inviting you to drift and dream. It's like a lecture in that it resists summing up and instead leaves you throwing up your hands and saying, I had to be there. Fortunately, because it is a book, you can be there. And fortunately for us, the incomparable Mary Capello is here right now. Mary Capello, welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you so much, Eric. It's just really a pleasure to be here and to have the chance to talk with you.
Well, this for me is a rich and layered pleasure. It's a truffle of a pleasure because I had the benefit of hearing the lecture live on which this book about the lecture that is in itself a lecture is based. And I can just say right off the bat that it was one of the most dazzling intellectual performances that I've ever encountered. And your book is so very much a celebration of the lecture in all its possibilities. And so I just want to begin by making a declaration of how wonderful it was to see you embody those possibilities. So I come here as a fan, full of gratitude for your ability to bring the lecture to life. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, this lecture is in some ways a response to the lectures you love and that impulse that drives the book?
Yeah. Well, first to say thank you for reminding me of that wonderful experience that really was the origin of this project altogether. And for you to describe the experience that you had of that lecture is quite a gift to me. But I want to mention that maybe this tells us something about the lecture, in essence, which is to say, it wasn't just a matter of my arriving to the occasion of that podium in a really happy way, which I absolutely did, but that the success of that lecture had a lot to do with you and your colleagues and students and the people who were in the audience. So much of what becomes possible when we allow ourselves to think publicly and to perform this beautiful thing that is the lecture. So much depends, of course, on the locale in which we are incited and invited to do that, and the other minds and hearts and lives and bodies that are in the room. Having said that, of course, then this raises the question of what happens when the lecture translates to the page. And as you know, I very much stand behind the affiliation that inheres between the lecture and the essay. And so it didn't take a whole lot of translating to move from stage to page. At the same time, one of the things I address in the book is the way in which the page affords things that performance does not, and performance quite definitively affords things that the page does not. I'm sort of actually more interested in the latter than the former. But as we're talking about a book that we hope people will want to buy, I don't want to downplay the beauty and power of actual books. The project, though, really takes its origin in a question that has always preoccupied me, I think, from the start of my career as a student and as a writer and a thinker. And that has to do with not taking for granted the forms by which we convey knowledge and understanding, or for that matter, the forms by which we carry out or manifest publicly the art that we make. I'm thinking about readings, the tried and true reading, for example. And so I'm as interested in the lecture as a form that I very much believe, of course, could use some revisiting, as I am in modes like the panel presentation. I was recently thinking more about the nature of the seminar, because I participated in something called a webinar. And to be honest, I couldn't see that there was any relationship between the thing that I was asked to do in a Zoom webinar and the beautiful entity that is a seminar. But maybe one more thing to say about the origin of the book then. I came to a passage in thinking about, you know, how I might respond to a question like this. A passage that I wrote after I had already edited the book, wrote the book, it went through editing, and then I added a paragraph to the book version of the lecture. And I come back to this paragraph because I think that I want to read it. It's very short, because I want to suggest to readers that it really speaks to what I was after. Why was I wanting to reanimate the lecture? It has to do with, in an era that is opposed to thought, in an era maybe, in fact, right now, where thought is even being obliterated, I was thinking that I wanted to create a kind of organization, maybe even, that would be called the Friends of Thought, over and against Republicans and Democrats. They're the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Friends of Thought. And the Republicans and the Democrats give speeches, and we Friends of Thought give lectures. If I just may read these very few sentences, more and more, I have come to understand that the lecture, it's on page 44, wants nothing so much as to touch us, to instruct us in the power inherent in looking kindly on thought. If I could learn to look kindly on thought, I might come to look more kindly at, to hear with more compassion, the stuff that my own mind produces that I fail to understand. The lecture embraces, it has learned to love, ideas. At best, it listens and looks out for a voice intent on singing, no longer cowed before the bully pulpit of the mind. And needless to say, I had in mind not just the literal bullies who have enjoyed at least 4 years now of a great deal of airtime before political pulpits, but the internalized pulpit then of our own minds, and the way in which I think the sort of loathsome bullying before the pulpit that we've all been made to sort of listen to for quite a long time now is readily easily translated into a kind of self-loathing. And so openness to listening out, to listen for a voice that is in short supply.
Yes, yes. And I think this would be a perfect moment to underscore this investigation of the lecture that you're doing, in the sense of what you're imagining the lecture to be over and against what it is not. So you're imagining the lecture as a form of openness and possibility and discovery and surprise and recovery and rejuvenation. And of course, there are sort of these associations of the lecture as boring, as information dump. I mean, no one will find in this book a recourse to a PowerPoint slide, which has right to be the dominant form of the lecture right now. So could you tell us a little bit more about the inheritance of the lecture that you want to recover over and against what we've seen, and what yes, so many of us experienced as the lecture is this kind of colossal form that we must accommodate, sometimes made by little orange men.
Sure. Well, the inheritance that I have in mind, of course, asks us to think about the relationship, again, the affiliation between historically the essay and the lecture. And it's possible that that fell out of the equation in the course by which education came to maybe colonize the lecture or institutionalize the lecture. But if you think of course, one of the most famous examples, Ralph Waldo Emerson's lectures and the way that they've been described and what he was trying to do when he lectured. And the fact that his lectures, of course, in almost every case, his essays started as lectures that he delivered in the circuit known as the Lyceum, the American Lyceum. And what was it he was talking about? A form that he'd yet to see really done well, and that was open to surprise. And he used the phrase, a panharmonicum of thought. He suggested that the lecturer needn't know in advance what form it was going to take. And it required, in fact, that the lecturer be as willing to succumb to its forces as an audience might, you know, to in other words, not think of what one was doing as an ascension to mastery and arriving at a point, but more so to embody for an audience the way, a form of transport. I really, what I love about, what many things I love about being in the presence of a great lecturer is the chance to be taken out of myself as I know myself and to some other place. I mean, in a way, it's what all great art does for us, I think. But so, of course, I have in mind lecturers like Emerson, like Thoreau, like Wolfe, of course, even though she did not like to lecture. But I also, Eric, am not so much interested in, and you know, I could also draw attention to the various essays that I was had the pleasure as a student of attending. I quote one of them at length in my book, Martin Popps, whose lectures, you know, transcribed really read like a combination of poetry and essaying. So I could refer to these models that take us back to the history of the form, to earlier periods, that take me back to remembrances of experiences that enabled me to wake up and go to sleep at the same time. But I really want to emphasize that I'm almost more interested in asking a readership to imagine with me the lecture that does not yet exist and has not yet been invented and that might be required by our time and might meet a need that we can articulate together. And so I'm not really compelled to give you lots of examples of what it is I am trying to describe. And this puts me in mind actually of a word I wanted to bring into our conversation that's been preoccupying me lately. And it's the word speculate. I've been thinking about the fact that we are right now in a moment where I don't know a person who has not been, at least since March, who has not had to give themselves over to speculation pretty much on a daily basis as we live in a pandemic. And by speculation, then, I mean we are all always trying to understand what might be next, what is in store for us. Will we find a vaccine? Will it be developed by this date or that date? Who will have access to it? Am I going to contract the disease? How can I protect myself? Will we see each other in person ever again? I mean, we could go on and on and on, you know, with the kinds of speculation that the virus has required of us. Then we have, in addition to that, layered on top of this, we have the election and the week that we just endured as a nation state and that we continue now to try to comprehend. And of course, we just dealt with one of the hardest weeks in the history, I think, of this nation state in terms of anticipating and speculating about what the outcome might have been or might be. I am happy. I am elated in many ways with the outcome. And in other ways, of course, we had hoped even for better outcomes in the House and in the Senate. But at the same time now, of course, we're dealing with the requirement that we be perpetually and continuously anxious because the president is refusing to concede the very clear win of Joseph Biden. So I'm thinking about the fact that I have, for one, been beset by various sorts of speculation, but that word is actually a really important one for the kind of thinking, listening, and writing that I have in mind in my book. And that is that the word speculation, of course, at its best, has imagining in mind, the power of the imagination, and a willingness not to know what's next. So if you'll excuse this this lengthy exegesis that I'm like laying out here in response to your question, I'm trying to say that I think I'm afraid that something of the speculative has been lost to us. Because the kind of speculating that we've been required to engage in is based on fear. And the kind of speculating that I think makes possible life and compassion and, that is the essence of thought is a kind of speculating that can't know. It depends on not knowing what's next, not needing to know what's next, and being open to, in fact, the beauty of surprise. So I don't know if this strikes you in any particular way, but I'm trying to answer your question about, what am I thinking of in terms of exemplification of the lecture I have in mind by saying, yes, in some ways I can point to many, many different examples, including, in the book, I talk about just the way that James Baldwin answers a question is a gorgeous lecture/essay. And we could go down the alley of a variety of different examples, but I'm really more interested in the lecture that we haven't yet invented and that could speak to the needs of our times. And I think that at the very least, we need to reclaim the terms of speculation. I was reading and teaching a book by Heather Crissell called The Crying Book a few weeks ago. It's a book-length lyric essay on the nature of tears and on crying. And in it, she quotes Ann Carson. I have to say, I didn't know this passage from Ann Carson when I wrote my book, a lecture, and I want to share it with you because it speaks to this question as well of the necessity of being unprepared. Being willing to be unprepared. My favorite part, this is Ann Carson, is connecting the ideas. The best connections are the ones that draw attention to their own frailty. So that at first you think, what a poor lecture this is. The ideas go all over the place. And then later you think, but still, what a terrifically perilous activity it is. This activity of linking together all the threads of human sin that go into making what we call sense, what we call reasoning, an argument, a conversation. How light, how loose, how unprepared and unpreparable is the web of connections between any thought and any thought. And so when you think of the abandon and almost a sense of radical freedom that is implied in Carson's sentence, I think that that's not really something we have much access to right now. And I think that we need to have access to that if I really think it has everything to do with social change and just really the ability to maintain one's sanity. We need our imaginations in order to remain sane. We don't need endless speculating about things that we cannot know.
It's a beautiful passage. Thank you for sharing it. I find myself thinking about, actually, I'm just rotating over everything that you brought up. But the question then, I suppose, that stands before me is the way in which it seems to me like you're constantly kind of looking at these forms, the lecture, the speculation, the speech, and making very fine distinctions between what they can offer us at their best over and against where they sort of shear off into the demagogue, into the authoritarian, into the the life quashing, right? The lecture is this terrible experience. The lecture is this moment of transport. Speculation is this thing that's now being forced to on us in a state of trauma and anxiety and fear versus speculation as a celebration of the possibilities of the imagination and what can be wrought from them. And it's something that I've always admired about your thinking. Your nuance. You're just so nuanced, and you're not willing to let go of the complexity of what you enter into. And I think I see that as being so alive in your writing itself. It's writing that moves forward, listening to its own possibilities and letting them unfold. Which I think takes us back to what you said about Emerson, with the idea that even the lecturer himself, herself, their self need not know what's going to happen, because you give yourself over to the grip or the inspiration or the unfolding. And that's that moment of discovery when the web starts to come together.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Eric. Thank you so much for that beautiful description of what you experience in the reading of this writing. I'm struck by your acknowledgement of my interest in making distinctions between things. I think of James Baldwin again. I know one thing from another, he says. You know, I know that I was born, I'm going to live, and I'm going to die. And this is in this famous meditation that you can find on YouTube, where he was interviewed on television and was in this one passage of the interview, he is saying that he's explaining what he means when he wants to say, I am not the N-word. You know, I am not the N-word. And it's so moving. That moment where he quite starkly lays out this pronouncement that I know one thing from another. And I spent a lot of time in my teaching actually asking that my students cultivate what I call discernments. And I asked them to think a lot about and write about words that seem quite close to one another, but that are not to be conflated with one another. And it's not so much then that I'm ultimately interested in, you know, a definitive distinction being drawn between the speech and the lecture. I'm a lot more interested, as you point out, in the magnetic space that exists between these things that are unlike, but also like. And it really is in that space between the two that I think something beautiful can emerge. And a friend of mine, I suppose it will sound like self-aggrandizing to quote a friend saying something nice about my work, but my friend and fellow writer James Morrison once said to me about my writing, and he reads everything that I write before anyone else does. He said, you are always working toward nuance. And he also coined for me a phrase that he thinks describes my work. He's always called my work lyric intellectual. And I guess I mentioned both of those things because, yes, I think that one of the things that gets us into lots of problems is the insistence on drawing stark contrasts between things in an oppositional way, as opposed to discovering what can become possible. And right, what really is always in front of us? I mean, the world is made up of synchronicities. That is the fact of the matter. That this window I'm looking out of right now, you know, there are stripes made up of various forms of life that are coexisting side by side. My little consciousness can't possibly be adequate to them, but I think as writers, we have the responsibility to try to make some of those adjacencies visible or audible. And I think that unfortunately, where the current demagoguery of our nation state is concerned, it's a bit of a truism, but perhaps it's true that what people found appealing in Donald Trump's pronouncements was precisely that they are pronouncements, and precisely that they lack nuance altogether. They're very, very cut and dry. And I guess that makes some people feel protected and cared for. It makes them feel less desperate. But you know, I wrote a book on awkwardness some years ago, and it was driven by the idea that we could afford, can't we afford to dwell more in uncertainty? And isn't that what we all share, in fact? The fundamental vulnerability of being human, the fundamental precarity. I think that our current president refuses to acknowledge his own mortality, actually. And I think that whenever you have someone who propounds a kind of omnipotence relative to themselves, it's a blatant denial of the fact of the matter that he, like I and you, is mortal. And he must therefore acknowledge not the infinitude of his power, but quite the obverse, the extent and limit of his power as a human. So I guess I'm trying to say, you know, I see myself as a writer, as someone who, in the little life that I'm given, I devote myself to the glorious nature of nuance. Yes. And I can't really ever adequate it in my work, but I try. And it's the beautiful challenge of being alive. That is the beautiful challenge of being on the planet.
Yeah, when I'm thinking of your work, I'm thinking of it as you refuse to sever or cauterize off something in order to make it fit or work. And so then you get like beautiful awkwardnesses, and you get the charge between categories. You get, instead of ossification, live energy. And that feels so precious, right? Like I respond to that as a reader, that possibility, that charge. And, you know, one of the pleasures of preparing for this interview was that I got to hear another interview with you in which you talked about being in conversation with your mother as a possible kind of deep structure for why it is that your sensibility is open to this. I wondered if you'd share a little bit of that with our listeners.
Sure. And I'm so glad that you referenced that, because what I didn't think to mention when you asked me about how I might exemplify the lecture that I have in mind is that absolutely I would encourage our fellow listeners, readers, thinkers, writers, people to look for these forms that we're interested in places where you don't imagine them to be occurring. And that's really the most exciting place to find them, not even where we expect to find them in the university, you know, in the auditorium, but in the daily. And my mom, any conversation with her is an essay slash poem slash lecture in the best sense of that word. My mom has a capacity to move among and around and through lots of different discourses in any one conversation. And so she takes the pulse of the day in some way. She usually is reminded, no matter what we're talking about, of a snippet of poetry or of a song or of a film. And she gives herself over to humor. And I have tried, sometimes I actually take notes when I have conversations with my mother, because I think I am in the presence of something that should be recorded. And I don't know that I could write an essay that would move so deftly and beautifully from A to Q to D to F in the way that she just did. And so, yes, my mom is a great model for me in that. And I was just, before talking to you, revisiting an essay I've been trying to write since July about the lecture in the age of Zoom. And the first half of which is a bit of a screed against online learning. And I don't consider screeds to be essays. So, you know, I'm not happy with the first part of my essay. But I discovered that as I kept writing, what the essay really wanted to be was a meditation on my mom's conversations and my 10-year-old nephew's art making during this time in the pandemic of real isolation and depression for him as he tries to learn via Zoom, and my 5-year-old niece's creation of collages, and what the children in my family and also the elders in my family are teaching me about vital ways that we have available to us for making meaning and making sense. And in that, you know, with an emphasis on the word meaning, making, not meaning, but making. So yeah, I hope that answers your question, that what I would hope for the lecture to become is imminent in the acts of the imagination that I'm happy to be present to, that I see in my family, you know, right now. And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that one way to maybe describe the phenomenon we're talking about is not calling anything out prematurely before it might speak and reveal what it needs to say. And, you know, one of the, you know, anybody who's been listening now for 32 minutes will have a very clear sense that you are an extremely intellectual and erudite person. And that I celebrate in your work. What I celebrate is that goes hand in hand with a tremendous sense of humanity and humaneness, which those two pieces don't always go together. If you're an intellectual lyricist, you're also an intellectual compassionist or something like that. And this is all leading me to thinking about, you know, one who would encounter this work would encounter Audre Lorde on the lecture and Virginia Woolf on the lecture and Foucault on the lecture and the way you're pulling these pieces together. But there's this moment where you talk about what equally or perhaps even more so informs your sensibility and thus the possibility for this kind of work and the possibility for this kind of thinking. And you call it the Uncommon Archive.
Yes.
It's on page 116. It's sort of something like the deep structure of what you're drawing on in order to create this work. I would love it if you would read that passage. It's just so on page 116, you talk about the Uncommon Archive, and then you begin to, you do a catalog, a list of these moments that are kind of deep in your consciousness and body that shape the work that we've been reading all along.
Oh, thank you, Eric. I'd be most happy to read that passage, certainly. Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. What Virginia Woolf did not do, and what I wish she could talk to us about from the great beyond, was to create a form of lecturing that could adequate the radical inventiveness of her fiction. There is so much that lies unrevealed in the lecture in general, and in this lecture in particular. Though a reader might assume that my sources are in evidence as citations, my thinking, just like yours, actually derives from a mostly invisible uncommon archive, my pet phrase, or what Bart would call a plurality of desires and reservoir of perversions that lay at the heart of any creation and must be allowed free play. As textured as our notes and untranslatable, they include for me my mother's agoraphobia and the time bomb that was my father, the boom of my father's voice that knocked out each rib that held a breath in place, and sometimes his hand, the scent of a gardener's gardenias in my mother's hair. The gardener was my father. The sound that broke the dinner plates in the same moment it killed the little girl next door when a bullet aimed at her father struck her down instead. The daily search for the antidote. My first encounter with the word crepuscular. My sense there was something to be learned of crenellations. Getting lost in a department store when I was 7 and in a snowbank when I was 8. The particular gracefulness of a flying squirrel who glided across branches in a future sleep. The tendency to curve, coil, spring, and screw in spite of all the world's attempts to straighten, stiffen, and stuff.
That's wonderful. It's just wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Well, this question of when people come to books and they want to know, what made you write this book?
Yes. Right?
Where did this come from? And of course, the academic approach, as we know, is to have our citations lined up in a row and our footnotes and works cited as our sources. And as you know, as the magnificent essayist that you are, our sources are multifold and often inarticulable. I very much think that it's important to identify our unspoken sources to the extent that we can, even as we allow them to do their work without our needing to know what exactly they are. So, yes, thank you for asking me to draw attention to that passage in particular, because, you know, I think that list offers a set of answers that one could not anticipate. I can talk at length about in what sense each of those things in the list called for this book. Obviously, the link between them is not obvious, but I suppose the one that I became most aware of once I translated the lecture that I delivered at Ohio University into this book is the one having to do with violence, and realizing that because I grew up in a violent neighborhood and I went to a Catholic school where corporal punishment was the order of the day, and because I grew up in a violent household actually as well, I know that my interest in the lecture has also everything to do with wanting to unwed, as you put it, you know, authoritarianism from pedagogy And with that, to bring back into what we think of as the classroom, something like attention and nurture and tenderness and love. And I was revisiting before talking to you this wildly interesting little book called A Lecture on Lectures, which I cite in my book by Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, or otherwise known as Q, and the Hogarth Press published, Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf's Press published this little book. I was able to get a copy of it. No library seemed to carry it anymore, but I actually have a first edition in my hands. And I want to share with you a sentence from his lecture on lectures, because it speaks to this, the necessity of love, I think. He wrote, "The truth I mean is this, that when a number of persons are met for a purpose in itself unselfish, and the love of learning is that, there often prevails over the assembly a strange congregational spirit, recognizably good by any individual member, yet not his own, yet nothing he consciously brought, but unlocking rather some sense that people have more good in common than they pretend to, if only some other person have the gift or art to unlock it." And I changed man and men to people in his quotation just now. but good. I guess two aspects of what he says here that I just love. The idea that when we come together in the name of learning, that we are coming together, we are met for a purpose in itself unselfish, that the love of learning is essentially an unselfish premise for coming together. I love that. And then this idea that when we have been in the presence of a great lecturer in this unselfish context, something gets unlocked in us. You know, and that somebody does have the gift to unlock that.
I find myself in a position choosing between what I think is selfishness and something greater. And so what I'm going to do is, instead of pushing on to one of these many questions that I still have before me, is that I'm going to thank you for that beautiful answer. And I'm going to thank you for being one of those people that makes that love of learning and that possibility for the shared love through it to manifest and to occur. And to say, Mary Capello, I couldn't be more grateful for the fact that you shared your time with us today.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you very much.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Mary Capello, author of Lecture, here on the New Books Network.